Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Toby Hemmings. Marcel Duchamp once said that not everyone is an artist, but everyone is a critic. While he may have been biased, these days this does ring true. Anyone can write and publish a review online. You can rate experiences out of stars, from movies to purchases to car rides. So what does this accessibility, this ease of passing judgment, mean for the role of the cultural critic? Traditionally, the critic is driven by an immense knowledge of their subject and a passion for the field. But with shrinking column inches and a crowded online landscape, is there still space for Australian cultural commentary? Does working as a critic still bear fruit, or is it all rotten tomatoes? Earlier, I was joined by three eminent voices in Australian arts writing. Michael Sun is an editorial assistant in culture and lifestyle for The Guardian, where he hosts the internet culture podcast Saved for Later. He's also a freelance film and music critic for The Monthly and ABC Arts. Lauren Carol Harris is a writer and curator. She has contributed cultural criticism and arts journalism to Cineast, The Baffler, The Saturday Paper, Senses of Cinema, and The Monthly's website, among others. Alison Croghan is an award-winning novelist, poet, theatre writer, critic, and editor. She is the arts editor for The Saturday Paper and was co-founder and editor of the performance criticism website Witness. What do you think the role of the critic is in 2021? And I'll start with you, Lauren.
Yeah, it's a huge question. I think it's one where, you know, everyone on this panel is probably thinking about every day and putting into practice. And to be really dorky and nerdy, I'd say that one of the differences between, you know, everyday bloggers and consumer reviewers that you're talking about, Toby, and a professional arts critic is that arts criticism is a practice. Going beyond the examples you use, Toby, of consumer reviews, is this movie worth spending your money on to buy a ticket on? Is this show worth spending your time on? I think arts criticism, it speaks to something that's going on in the world today, to be really kind of broad and fluffy. But, you know, the art critic will give the audience a lens, and it's a kind of subjective lens in some ways to view an artwork through. And there is actually some objective knowledge involved. So, you know, we tend to know the history of the genres that we're talking about, the art forms that we're talking about, and we put a lot of context around a work, whether that's talking about, say, a film director's body of work, putting it into perspective with the cultural politics of today. So it's going a fair bit beyond, do I like it or am I not into it?
I mean, social media and search engine optimization has seen that opinion proliferate, though. We're seeing people like music. You know, pop culture is often recapped on smaller websites in a pithy, clickable format. Michael, do you think that audiences conflate opinion with criticism?
I think definitely to some extent. And I think it's interesting that you talk about how anyone now can obviously share their opinion willy-nilly very easily. But I think as I was thinking about this, I guess the difference for me is that anyone can be a critic, and I'll get into that a bit later, but very importantly, not everyone is a critic. And I think I really agree with what Lauren said, where arts criticism is a professional practice. Like, this is something that is actually a profession, right? It's not something that a random letterboxed reviewer, I don't think I would consider them working in the field of criticism so much as working in the field of dispensing opinions on social media, which is a very different thing. But I think criticism as a whole should be a professional practice where you're actually situating the work within context, and not to repeat what Lauren just said, but like a lot of it is about providing context, providing deeper information, providing a lens through which to mediate between the work and the world and yourself and the viewer and the consumer themselves in a way that I don't think can be done by more pithier work that we see on social media. I'm not saying that you need any particular kind of training or like formal education to be a critic. I think, as I said, anyone can be a critic, but I don't think we should just willingly consider everyone a critic, which is unfortunately a view that's becoming more and more popular nowadays. I mean, you mentioned people having their favorite films. I feel like it's something that we see in particularly things like the Marvel press cycle, where there are a lot of just like independent bloggers who are essentially just acting as PR for these movies. And they have almost a kind of like reciprocal relationship with the film studio itself, where they get invited to like exclusive premieres and red carpet events, et cetera, et cetera. But are those people critics, or are they minions of Marvel themselves? I think is something worth considering.
Yeah, so breaking down that anyone can be a critic as opposed to anyone is a critic, it is that accessibility that we see now, that online spaces make it more accessible for people to engage in criticism, but that not everybody out here writing reviews on social media is actually doing the work.
Mm-hmm. I find this conversation really fascinating because of my own background. Like I started the first theatre review blog in Australia in 2004 in a very different iteration of the internet. Back then, it was exactly the same conversation. It was like, oh my God, here are all these amateur critics busy, you know, rising up and saying whatever they like and what authority do they have and whatever. And back then, what was happening between about 2004 and 2010, before the corporatization of the internet, before Google became, you know, God and all that kind of thing, was the internet provided an openness that actually in most cases, and especially in Australia, it was, first thing was that the blogging, and I'm talking specifically of theatre, but it's happened in film as well. I think Roger Ebert said it was like a golden age of television criticism or film criticism back then, was that all these very smart people got online and started talking to each other and having discussions with each other and also writing much more substantially about the kinds of work that they were looking at than was actually available in the print media. And it was basically print media back then. So what the internet offered then, with all the usual tussles around, you know, legitimacy, as I said, it's so fascinating, the same questions of legitimacy, it's still being asked, was a space where something could be considered in a way that was outside specialist publications that could be available and accessible to readers. And they were. I suppose back then I was thinking, well, the link between amateur and professionalism, I've always felt a little kind of, you know, just because I have a job, I have the authority was the kind of thing back then. And I still feel a bit suspicious about that, that I always felt like criticism earns its authority through what it says. But basically, I agree, there's a huge difference between the kind of consumer review, which I think is still pretty dominant in most media. It's become just much more kind of atomized.
I'm so glad you raised that issue of authority and legitimacy, Alison, because it's something I think about a lot. Like, on the one hand, we are probably quite skeptical of it because a lot of the traditional critics in mainstream mastheads got a lot of assumed authority because they were writing for, say, the Sydney Morning Herald, and because they were kind of like old white guys, you know?
Yeah,
and, institutional authority. And now I think, you know, another way of looking at it is, well, with the slow death of arts writing, which critics are coming up who actually do have healthy authority with the general readership, with the general public? The lack of, you know, emergent or younger critics who can't build any authority among the broader readership, it's kind of a problem for the arts.
It's
not a good sign of a healthy arts criticism or like that discourse that we need.
Yeah.
I was just going to say then, is authority then conveyed by that audience? Is authority then conveyed by people reading you and saying, yeah, I trust you. I believe what you're putting forward to me. It makes me interested. I'll go engage with the work now.
I think
you have to earn the authority as a critic rather than assuming it according to your institution or your demographics. Like, so I'm a pretty rogue individual. I don't know how normal people live. I don't know what normal middle class life is like. So I have worked very, very hard to, you know, be able to say things that might be considered a bit radical or challenging, but to frame them in such a way through arts criticism that people will listen. And because arts criticism is a little bit about the art of persuasion, you know, so yeah. If you work hard to build a dialogue with your readership and open up a conversation rather than shut it down and be like, this show is good or this show is bad, then I think that's a better way of trying to approach the question of authority and how to be productive and use that authority wisely, maybe.
Yeah, this notion of like audience, though, is really interesting to me as well, because I think you can't really just say that an audience gives you authority, because then you get questions like, is an influencer an authority? Because I'm sure that a large part of their audience would also trust them if they recommended it like a cultural artifact. I think I really agree with this point that you have to earn the authority by, and like, I hate to say it, but I feel like some part of it, you have to prove your authority, right? It's like you have to build your profile, even if it's through non-traditional, non-institutionalist ways. I feel like you have to build your profile somehow and earn your stripes.
Yeah, and I also think that you earn your stripes and you earn them in everything you write. Mm. That's how you earn them. So there's no point where you're going, well, I am now the authority, because I think there's a real seduction of critical authority is that then you just assume the mantle of it and then that's what you are. And as, you know, like Lauren, I've spent most of my life outside institutions and I just have had to make my own way basically in Australian culture. So I've had all sorts of interesting kinds of collisions with different kinds of authority, or having authority ascribed to me in ways I find incredibly uncomfortable. Speaking to my practice as a critic, it's like every time I sit down, I have to make my case. And I think as an editor, that's what I ask my critics to do as well. Like, what is in front of you? What is the work you're talking about? Why is it important? Those things happen in the moment.
Yeah, being really informed, really well researched, knowing the stuff, knowing the history.
Yeah, doing the work. I mean, I did think, you know, the journalist flew off to talk to Adele and bothered to listen to her record. Like every single artist in Australia sighed hard on that, because we've all been in that position where you've turned up in an interview and you know that the person you're talking to has zero idea or interest in what you actually do. I mean, that's just so common. That's the kind of thing that a good critical culture will kind of push against.
I almost wish that, you know, some of these institutional critics should probably be losing some authority with the things that they're putting out. I mean, I'm especially thinking about, I mean, arts criticism has been in the spotlight a lot over the past few weeks. I'm thinking about the Rupert and Lachlan Murdoch exhibition. That's an example of someone who should have instantly lost authority based on what they had written. Like, authority needs to be earned and maintained. Like, I don't think you ever reach a stage where it's just like, that's it, I'm done, I now have my chokehold.
That was one of the funniest things that's happened. As a critic, you can miss things. I mean, no one's infallible. It's also every critic's nightmare that you go along and miss the totally obvious thing. Certainly, I've been in different critical cultures where there's a sense of embattlement around the critic and the critic is hostile to the work. And I've also been in cultures, specifically when blogging was really big in Melbourne in the early 2000s, and there were quite a few really smart blogs around all talking to each other. But they weren't just talking to each other, there were conversations that included the artists, they included audience members. There were really interesting things going on there that I actually don't know are possible now. But what that conversation showed was that it was not about critics making judgments. It was certainly something I was reacting against in my generation, that the critic came along, you know, the critic from The Age or The Australian or whatever, and there was only one. Gave their judgment and that was the end of the conversation.
You think about the trope about, for example, in New York and in Broadway, that a negative judgment sinks you. That's it. It's the final word. It's the punctuation mark.
And I actually think, however chaotic things are now, and they are, and they're stressful and they're difficult in lots of ways, I still think what's going on now is better than that.
Well, let's talk about what's going on now. And I mean, the work of actually being a critic is seemingly incredibly tenuous. Lauren, you recently wrote in the Sydney Review of Books that surviving freelance is like chasing a sheet of sand. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Oh, yeah, man. Let me tell you. I mean, I wrote that piece because Because I noticed this really dire phenomenon whereby I'd get together with friends who were also writers, and we wouldn't talk about art and we wouldn't talk about writing, we'd just talk about money. And I realized that the freelance writers were kind of like the Uber drivers of the media and arts landscapes, in that we were taking the brunt of a lot of the defunding of the arts on the one hand and the decline of traditional arts press on the other hand, because of all these, you know, normal late capitalism things like digitization, and it's because of the casualization of the whole workforce. Yeah, I think arts writing, it's the first kind of page to go in a declining mainstream masthead. And so the way they deal with that is to fire their full-time salaried writers and critics and arts journalists and investigative arts journalists. And everyone's doing this, right? Like the ABC is doing this, the Guardian's doing this. Like everyone who we've worked for in this panel is doing this, basically. And so I wrote that piece that you're talking about, Toby, to offset this this phenomenon of the slow death of arts writing against, like, what's it like in the gig economy? What's it like to survive when you know the economy doesn't have any place for you, when you've got no fallback? And the people who do make it through, I think, to full-time salaried positions or permanent part-time or actual, like, jobs, you know, as we used to call them, are people who come from like a slightly more privileged class background. And so I was thinking about class as an aspect of diversity that we probably don't talk about quite enough.
I think that's completely true, but I think that's a fact that exists all the way through the arts.
Yep.
And not just in Australia. It's something I'm really conscious of, actually, and have been as a writer and as a artist, someone reading culture. I think it's particularly visible in literary culture that we have a very, very middle-class dialogue going on and a lot of really interesting voices that are tough and need to be heard and smart. Just you don't get to hear them. They offend people too much. Part of dialogue is being able to hear and listen. I think we have a great deal of difficulty in Australia dealing with the whole concept of criticism. Speaking as a critic who is being banned in my younger years from theatres for upsetting people, and I stopped.
You were cancelled?
I was totally cancelled. When I started doing theatre, I was working for a big, you know, national weekly bulletin, kind of just fell into that job. I think all of us fall into criticism. So because I hadn't been to university, I kind of approached it in a very beetle-browed way. This will be my, you know, everything I do. I'll study really hard and I'm a very serious young insect. Anyway, after 2 years, I really upset people and I got banned and I was on 60 Minutes as the bitch critic. And that was a very formative experience for me, that because after that I just went, okay, you know, the kinds of money. I was a sole parent back then. I had two very small children. And I sort of did a few sums and I figured that I actually got more on the sole parents pension, this was back then in the late 80s, than I did writing these reviews that got me all these poison pen letters. And so I just left it all together for over a decade. I just didn't want to do that. I just upset people too much. When I decided that I wanted to review again, there was nowhere where it was possible for me to get a job. And that's why I started the blog and did that for 8 years. That was only possible because I wasn't being paid. And I wasn't being paid because I was earning enough money from my books to live on. So I had that luxury. And again, in the last 10 years, all of that's just fallen to bits.
Yeah, I think that Australian attitude towards criticism is really worth us talking about. And I think quite a common attitude in Australia, I feel, even amongst some critics, unfortunately, is this idea that because the Australian arts industry is viewed as this like very emerging cottage industry, it's like everyone knows each other, everyone, you know, like the role of a critic is to uplift like emerging artists, which is just like, it's such a sham, right? Because it actually prevents people from giving honest reviews, as you said, Alison. I think both the arts industry and the arts writing sector, they both suffer as a result because people do not get honest reviews of their work. I think it's especially prevalent in music, where you see a lot of these smaller music blogs, which have kind of like broken a little bit into the mainstream, but they essentially just become like a PR arm of the musician and the label as well, where everything you read is just, and I'm sorry to use this word, but it just feels like slop. It feels like every piece is just like a rewritten PR release. And it's really disappointing to see that this is the kind of baseline that actually gets clicks and gets readership and gets an audience at the expense of exciting, honest criticism and critical work.
I totally agree. And it's the corporatization of the internet. Blogs were mainstream. Suddenly every newspaper had blogs and they turned into something else. But on the other hand was seeing institutions, and more recently since I've been an arts editor, watching how film PR works, and I found that a bit kind of amazing, actually, how it's like you apply to get an interview with someone. It's like, well, you know, excuse me. Sorry.
And they often decline.
Yeah. Like, no, you know, like, and then you'll get 5 minutes with somebody and you're supposed to, and it's like, wow, this is absolutely incredible, where the corporations that put out art of whatever kind, from theatre companies to huge film corporations, absolutely about controlling the message. I think when Cameron McIntosh first started doing things like Cats and Phantom of the Opera, people started talking about critic-proof work, and I think we're seeing the absolute apotheosis of that now with like Marvel films, the kind of films that everybody hates but everybody goes to see.
Exactly.
It's weird.
This is an uncomfortable aspect of what we do, right? There is some kind of awkward positioning of arts criticism at the intersection of a bit of journalism, a bit of literature, and also we do feed into the marketing and publicity cycle, because most of what we're responding to is like, what's on this week? That's what's going to be commissioned in arts pages.
Yeah.
And it puts, we often don't like to talk about that, I think, because it's like, ugh, gross. But like, it puts us in a funny position, because we have to, as individuals practicing this practice that we're talking about, resist that intellectual timidity.
Isn't that part of being a critic anyway? Like, if you...
It really is.
If you're going to be a critic, you've got to be prepared to say those things. And some people just don't want to, yeah. And that's fair enough. I mean, looking at younger critics in particular, it's a particularly thankless job in terms of, you know, very often you write things and people will not be grateful. But also that there's no, in other places overseas, in big, you know, in London and America, there were full-time jobs for critics. There never has been here.
In terms of that PR cycle, do you find that, particularly you, Alison, I mean, as an arts editor, do you find it difficult to extricate your coverage at the Saturday paper from what's on, basically, or what is being pushed?
Well, I'm probably in a rather more luxurious position than someone who's trying to edit The Age, who has arts pages to put out every day. So I have my pages in the Saturday paper, and it's notionally a national paper. What it does mean is that, I mean, things need to, it's a newspaper, so things do need to be current, but we do ask our critics to think more, to go beyond the consumer review. And, yeah, you can do that to a deadline.
I feel like one of the really big issues as well, and this is also we've touched on slightly, is that there's just a real shortage of publications that are not like the big newspapers in Australia, which publish arts coverage and pay good amounts for it, I would say. And, like, I think that's, like, a massive reason why, especially, like, as a freelancer, like, I think we feel tied to the PR cycle, where it's, like, so much of my life is literally spent keeping a calendar of releases to know when to pitch on things, which is just ridiculous, right? Like, it's, like, if you want to get something published about, like, a retrospective or something that's out of step with something that's very topical or hooky, you have to go to specialist publications, which definitely do exist, and there are many of them, or like not many, but there are a number of them that are operating at a really high level in Australia, but they either will not pay or it's just not on the same level of recognition and, I guess, authority, again, to use that word, as some of the big national mastheads. So it feels like we're almost caught in this like catch-22, where if we want to publish things that are of our own interest, then we just have to accept sacrifices for it.
Yeah, I mean, I did this experiment a few years ago with a very dear friend, Robert Reed, where we tried to start a performance criticism website called Witness, which lasted for 4 years. But it was kind of interesting. This was pre-pandemic, pre-Morrison. It was a slightly different world where we began in 2017. And it seemed possible that we could maybe generate a place where there could be interesting critical responses from a wide diversity of critics, where we could train critics and maybe even pay people something worth their while. That was never possible, but we always paid people. And we closed that this year because we were basically doing what we didn't want to do, which was working for nothing. And people were like, oh, my God, you closed it. But because there's so few outlets, but you just can't work for nothing forever and ever. Mm. And what was very clear to me was that the kinds of things, there's the academic or, as you say, specialist press criticism, and then there's, you know, mass media criticism, and there's something in between that is really important. That's criticism for a general public that acts as a hinge. That's the kind of criticism I'm interested in and have always written, that's accessible in a way to any interested reader. It's something that we really need in this country, and it's really the only way it's going to happen is if it's supported like the arts are.
I mean, is that the solve? Is that like a almost a government subsidy, basically, for criticism in the same way that we have subsidies for arts?
We got subsidised. You know, there's literary magazines that are subsidised less and less and less. And we didn't get subsidised much, but it was enough to, you know, almost make it worth our while. But it's just that thing of people say they, it was something I've sort of found my whole life. People say they want a really good critical culture. But when it comes to the really good critical culture being a kind of thing of spikes and questions, they're not so keen. And I don't know how we get around that one.
Part of a lot of the coverage of the arts, particularly of late with COVID, has been on how difficult it is, the lack of funding. Do you think that maybe that narrative is something people are more willing to engage with than the criticism themselves? And I might start with you, Lauren.
It's been a really worrying trend as long as I've been a working critic, whereby the arts press prefers to increasingly focus on the narrative of decline and crisis and defunding rather than commissioning new reviews, new coverage, new profiles of artists. And I notice it a lot. And I think there's a kind of addiction that to, like, you know, the arts gurgling going down the train, which is a much easier sell to readers, I suspect. So, for example, in 2013, when The Guardian Australia opened, they were commissioning 5 pieces a month on visual arts, usually by the critic Andrew Frost, who's, you know, very long-term respected. And now they mainly do big reviews of, like, the Biennale. But, you know, if you're working as an art critic, you hear a lot of conservatism among those members of the arts press who you'd think would have a bit more confidence. Arts editors say to me, you know, visual arts stories are a really hard sell to our readers. I think that kind of conservatism and self-censorship can seep into young critics as well. I've had young critics tell me, like, I work as a curator as well, so I'm often trying to get critical coverage. I would be very happy with negative reviews for the art that I help, you know, exhibit. And, you know, I get told by young freelancers, oh, no, that's too experimental to pitch to my editor. And then if I go directly to the editor, sometimes they're actually a bit more receptive than, you know, these kind of inhibited and fearful younger critics are. So I really avoid thinking that just being part of the arts press is a moral good. in and of itself. Like there's a lot of embattlement, a lot of victimhood going on, whereby people kind of think we're doing something innately good, and, you know, but actually I do think increasingly that the arts press is complicit in its own ways with the arts' downfall in Australia. And if we don't build up that confidence to be like, how are we going to use our reach to develop the audience for contemporary art, for new work by living artists, then we're only going to have lifestyle coverage. We're only going to have entertainment coverage. We're only going to be seeing film reviews of what's in theatrical release this week. And we're never going to have that deeper critical culture of, you know, longer form stories that maybe don't relate to something that is being released this week. So we're all part of this ecosystem. There's no one who gets to go through a loophole. Do you know what I mean? I really don't want to be like, you know, the poor arts press, like, we're all responsible for sustaining and nourishing what remains of the art sector.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely could not agree more. It's this whole idea where it's like, I so see this point where the arts press has become its own self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways. And I think it is the role of the editor to actually encourage a hunger in audiences to be going out and seeing things. And if an arts editor is not doing that, then I think, yeah, as you said, they are absolutely complicit in the decline of the arts as well, because it's quite literally a feedback loop where people don't go and see the arts, therefore the arts press don't cover it, therefore more people don't go and see it. It's just like...
It's a feedback loop for artists as well, because artists have lost their bread and butter by exhibition fees, opportunities to actually, like, work, you know, do the labour, and they're losing the critical conversation and the pathway to the audience at the same time. Yeah. So, yeah, that's why editors and mastheads are really part of this building a culture of bravery. How do we develop the art world? How do we develop the audience?
The answer to all of those is in a way quite simple and also incredibly complex. Like what you're describing is the age of Google Analytics. I've always felt the whole thing is a longer game, actually, that what you want to build, or what I want to build as an editor, is a kind of trust that people who look at my pages will see every week a bunch of really interesting stuff around different arts, and that's, you know, not doing the usual stuff, but something a little bit more in depth. Australian media as a whole has never been interested in the arts. They just think they're a soft option, part of features, not very important. And I think that's really indicative that the Auckley's only in the last, 5 years, finally introduced a prize for arts writing. They've had sports writing from the very beginning.
And only mid-year as well.
Yeah, no, mid-year on the children's table. I find it kind of insulting and always have. And because it's not really serious. And that's still a really embedded problem in most mass media. So this is why the narrative of doom or scandal is the thing that dominates how the arts presented to most people in Australia.
There seems to be this idea that as arts writers and arts editors, we have to have some level of like optimism for the future, right? Like I feel like looking at Google stats, looking at readership, that stuff is very cynical to me. I think that's symptomatic of an industry that's given up, you know, just pander to the masses. Why even try and change things when all that matters is clicks? I feel like that's really cynical. Whereas I think we have to have some degree of trust in the audience and optimism and look optimistically to the future that this can improve and this can change if we build an appetite for the arts and for experimental and innovative arts outside of the press cycle. But it requires, you know, a degree of trust.
I totally agree with you, Mike.
It's a tricky one because it's also, you know, building that trust. It can be difficult also when we've touched on that there is less of a hunger for critical work, which is critical, which is going to be not just how great it was. Wow, I loved this. Isn't this innovative? So it's a really interesting point to sit on. And look, I could listen to the three of you talk about this all day. I genuinely could. But I'm conscious that we all have other deadlines and other commitments to meet. So I do want to wrap. And I want to wrap with a bit of an interesting question. I'll get all of you to answer it. Who are the critical voices in Australia that you gravitate towards? Who's doing the work that you look at and you think, wow, that's really interesting. I'm really glad I read that. What are the authors or maybe publications that you would recommend to listeners or maybe just to your fellow panelists? And I'll start with you, Lauren.
I actually mainly read American publications because I really like the American nonfiction prose style where the prose just runs, it just flies. But in Australia, I do really rate the work that Sydney Review of Books is doing. You know, it's notable. They have institutional support, like they're linked to a major university. So, I mean, the money's coming from somewhere, you know. It's not people working for nothing. I don't know. I think because they are a book review platform that goes beyond books, like they've got really interesting columns of ideas, and that's what I look for. Like, who are the cultural critics who write about ideas, who are serious writers? So I always read Mireille Duchot and Maria Tamarkin, and I loved a piece by Richard Cook in a recent issue of the Monthly, a beautiful piece on what happened to homeless people in the pandemic in Sydney. But this was a beautiful piece of nonfiction writing that kind of had a background of politics to it that was very humane and personable about a group of people who are barely noticed, looked at, written about. That's the kind of work that makes me want to contribute to this critical culture even more, like even when I'm not really sure if Australia has faith in writing or contemporary art or ideas.
Mikey, how about you?
I feel like I'm going to really tell on myself right now. And like, there are definitely some names that I feel like whenever I see their name, I just have to read the work. And I think writers like, for example, Luke Goodsell, who knows how much I adore him, but like he's someone who every single word he writes is just like pure gold. I think someone else worth shouting out as well is Phoebe Chen, who everything that she's been producing for various American publications is just incredible and always so like stunningly analytical in a way that actually makes me question my entire understanding of the film that she's reviewing, which is always something that's great. And then I also, of course, love reading every single music column from the Saturday paper from Shard as well, who is Australia's best music writer.
I so agree with that. I love working with Shard, and he's so talented. I reckon a lot of the critics I work with are great. Tristan Harwood is another young critic who does visual art for us. His writing I totally adore, and he just brings a whole kind of freight of understanding to his work. He's got a beautiful review in the upcoming issue of the Saturday paper, which I'm like thrilled with. And I have to say that one of the really great aspects of my job is just collaborating with people and particularly younger critics and just watching them grow and develop. And it's something I find incredibly rewarding. But yeah, outside the Saturday paper, people like Sher Tan, who's a review editor at Mianjin, but her critical writing's like stunning, I reckon. And she's totally one of those really tough voices, tough, really smart, really erudite and honest that we need more of in Australian literature for sure. Probably lots more we haven't mentioned.
I mean, that's the thing. There's so many great voices, but I'm really glad that we were able to end a couple of really strong ones there. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining Fourth Estate today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics, and a whole lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. A big thanks to my executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Toby Hemmings. You can catch us next week on Fourth Estate.